comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
And welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, ladies and gentlemen, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. I'm delighted you're here. Welcome to talk radio like nowhere else on Earth. It's the show where you matter. We're here because you have a right to know. And you need to know about Command Sergeant Major Jim Norton, who was on the show last week. And as you will remember, Command Sergeant Major James Norton really unloaded a lot of information on us. And even, you know, before the show, I had talked with him about, you know, was he aware of some of the consequences that could befall him for disclosing what he was disclosing? And he said yes, but people have a right to know, and it was time, and he was going to tell what he knew. And I talked with him on the show, and I went through that same conversation with him on the show, and you'll remember that. Well, this morning I started getting information that people had not been able to get in touch with him for the past couple of days. So I started trying to get in touch with him. I couldn't get in touch with him. And so I prepared, you know, what flashed through my mind at that point was what we went through with Dr. Filipov in Bulgaria. And I was thinking, man, I hope there's nothing going on with Command Sergeant Major Jim Norton. I hope there's nothing going on with him like that. So, but I prepared a little brief statement about it and sent it out to our K-File subscribers. Or I started sending it out. I got about halfway through the list, sending it to about half of the people. And my telephone rang, and it was Command Sergeant Major James Norton. And I am happy to say he reports to me that there's nothing strange going on. He's just been excessively busy, and that he's fine and everything's cool. And he just wanted to let me know. So I guess someone had perhaps gotten in touch with him, or maybe he had listened, probably had listened to some of the voicemail that I had left for him. So he's okay. All right, now, God's in the Garden. God's in the Garden is a book that I wrote and published back in 2006. It's a boat rocker. And I will tell you this, even though it deals with Genesis, it's not your grandmother's Sunday school class, and it's not religious. If you haven't read it, you need to, and we're making it available this week as an ebook for $9 on the website. So if you haven't read the book, you can get it right now. You can download it right now, and you can read it right now. Okay? It's $9, and that's it. $9, and it's yours. But that only lasts till Saturday. We'll be back right after this. my guest this evening is Dr. Roger Lear. Dr. Roger Lear is known literally around the world for his work with a special category of people. Now, this category of people isn't real easy to describe because they come from all different walks of life, but what they have in common is they have discovered that there is some type of a foreign body, some type of, they suspect, an implant in their body. And in addition to that, there are circumstances that would lead one to think that it is possible that this might be what we call an alien or extraterrestrial implant. Dr. Lear and his team over the years have removed a number of these from people, and some of them with very strange, very curious properties. In addition to that, Dr. Lear is responsible for shooting some of the most amazing UFO footage ever seen. We're delighted to have him back with us this evening. Dr. Lear, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show.
Good to be with you again, Kevin.
Let's just start out. Before I want us to get to that UFO footage, let's start out with what's new in the world of Dr. Roger Lear and alien scalpel.
Well, that's a big piece to chew on. There's always something new. We've done 16 surgeries, and that has netted us 17 objects, all of which have had some scientific merit, except one. And this one was a very expensive piece of glass that had crystal-like characteristics. And I say expensive because the glass probably didn't cost that much, but the research did. we're batting about 99% here. All the rest of them had some scientific interest.
Let me tell you this. I went over to your website today. It's been a while since I've been over there. And it appears that it has had major upgrades. It's fancy now.
Well, thank you. It's a hard thing to do, really, to keep it updated.
It looks good. It really does. It's got a lot of great information there, and a lot of videos for people to watch and articles to read. Folks, if you go to my website and you click on Dr. Lear's picture, it will take you to his website. But if you don't want to go that route, Dr. Lear, go ahead and tell us the web address.
It's Alien, A-L-I-E-N, Scalpel, scalpel.com. AlienScalpel.com. And, of course, Alien Scalpel is only one word.
Mm-hmm. You know, when you put together, there are some of these implants that you've taken out of people have some really peculiar properties, and when you put that together with the video that you shot and what was discovered in that video, it brings up a whole universe of questions that either one of those by themselves would not bring up. It's a whole new realm of questions. And
that's my life, Kevin, is questions.
And I think for everyone who's involved, seriously involved, with anything to do with UFOs, there's a lot of questions, not so many answers, but a lot of questions. And, well, let me change that. There are answers, but we haven't found so many of them yet. Found some, but not not near enough. So lots of questions. Now, there's one of the implants, maybe more than one, but at least one of the implants that you have removed from people was actually transmitting a signal, and you were able to measure the radio frequency or the frequency at which it was transmitting. Tell us about that, and then we'll move, we'll head towards the UFO footage, but let's talk about that one for just a moment. Describe for us that implant and what you discovered about it.
It's a little more complex because we've had about five of them now that we found are emitting radio frequencies. And as good a memory as I have, I would get them mixed up. So I'd rather not quote the frequencies unless I had it in front of me. But let's suffice it to say that we have frequencies in both the megahertz and kilohertz ranges, which are in the FM band. And one of these we tracked through a semi-classified FCC document. And hold on to your hat, because this is a fixed or mobile deep space frequency.
Okay, and it's transmitting now, right?
That's correct.
All right, so now let me ask you a question about the transmitting, and then we'll talk about deep space frequency in just a moment. There are a lot of people, when we talk about implants, because there are a whole bunch of human-made implants that wind up in people, and they didn't know they were going to get it, and so there's a lot of articles being written about that and a lot of activist groups coming up about that. And one of the things that we hear about is that if you have something in you that's transmitting on a radio frequency or transmitting a frequency, that it can cause physiological problems. Can you tell us about that?
Well, as far as we know, there's quite a bit of difference between so-called man-made chips and what we find as the non-terrestrial characteristics of these objects. All man-made chips are representative of the status of the art of computer technology. So whatever you would expect to see in a computer, you might find as an implant, basically, a silicon chip, which is capable of acting as an electronic gate and letting information numerically do what it's supposed to do and either broadcast it or record it in some other manner. What we have here is a very advanced technology where we're using an electronic device on an atomic level where we're dealing with atoms and molecules of certain elements and in combination with each other to produce a highly advanced an electronic device. And what we're seeing is structures that are very, very tiny as far as the atom is concerned, because we find single-walled carbon nanotubes which can be wrapped on themselves, and these tubes can be doped so other elements can be put inside. And this is like the generation plant for a specific electronic assembly. Then you couple this with some rare earth elements and isotopes that are non-terrestrial. And again, you add into this crystals of varying size that are quite uniform. And then on top of this, we find structures which we have never seen before, such as ovoids and rectangular structures and little dells and things that we don't know what they do. So, you know, we're dealing with something which is extremely complex on a nanotechnological level, which far exceeds anything that man, or at least even the black budget technology, is dealing with here on Earth.
All right, so this implant then that you told us about that was transmitting on a deep space frequency, did it have any appearance at all of being man-made, or were you able to identify everything about this as being non-terrestrial?
Everything is non-terrestrial, and remember that when you find a certain finding, it raises the hackles, and you can say this could be an isolated anomaly. If you have two that resemble each other on metallurgical analysis or biological analysis that are similar, then you could say, well, you know, maybe this is accidental. But when you find three, four, five, six, or seven of them, which we have now, and they all represent the same kind of technology, then you got to say that this is a specific manufactured device, which is non-terrestrial.
Is there any way of, you know, when they, I guess they determine by what spectrometry, the makeup of the content of the metals and so forth in these objects, is that how they do it?
Oh, yes. There are certain tests that we run. I explained once before that that to make sense testing, why you start with non-destructive testing of the outside of the object. So we look at them with an optical microscope, which now they've gotten quite sophisticated, so we can get very high magnifications of the external structure of the object. Then we can go to the next level, which is called an AFM, an atomic force microscope, which uses the lasers and then gives you even a higher magnification and tells you about the surface topography of the object. And then once that is done, then you got to start looking deeper, so you do electron microscopy, which is called EDX, and you look at the breakdown of the atoms, and you can sputter them off with an electron beam, and you can get the elements that are contained in the object that you're looking at. Scanning electron microscopy, which is SEM, goes along with the EDX, so we can see at various levels by changing the strength of the electron beam. We can go to different depths in the object, and we can see what is going on, both metallurgically by looking at the elemental components, and also we can picture what structures they compose. So some of these tests do use many forms of spectroscopy. We have several tests that when we're looking for certain things, they are one is called ICP-MS. Another is Raman spectroscopy. So without going into a lot of technical details, which none of our listeners would understand, is let's say that a lot of these tests do use spectroscopy, and the Space Administration, when looking at things in outer space, such as the rocks on Mars, or stuff that's on the moon, or we use flybys of other planets, or looking at a comet or meteorites in transition, they can tell the same kind of information to a lesser degree. If you have a piece of a meteorite, or you have a piece of material that came from the moon or Mars, then it's much easier to tell what the constituents are, but when you do a flyby and you're using remote equipment to do this, it's not quite as accurate or sophisticated, but still you can get a good general idea, and this is being used continuously for space research.
Okay, so when you do all of this, you come up with a report, and the report somewhere in there talks about the isotopic ratios, right?
That's correct. And these are numerous reports, depending upon which test you do. So basically you get a result report from each one of the tests, and then it's up to the person that's ordering the test, which is not myself, believe me. I do not consider myself a scientist, but I'm more of a purveyor of information. And my goal is to get the objects, submit them for scientific analysis, and then to report this to the public. And that's what I've been mm-hmm. doing.
Okay, now, when we get the isotopic ratio, that's where they can identify, for instance, if it's iron, if there's some iron content. They can determine whether that's iron from the Earth or if it's iron from somewhere else in the universe, in other words, non-terrestrial, by means of that isotopic ratio. Is that correct?
Yes, that's absolutely correct, because if we mine metals or elements anywhere on the Earth, we may get an isotopic variance of around 2%. If we do analyses, for example, something that I think everybody can understand, the meteorite that came from Mars, when NASA examined it and made the statement that it contained life,
mm-hmm.
How do they know the meteorite came from Mars? It's very simple. We know what the isotopic ratios are from some of the materials from Mars, so we can identify that as coming from Mars. It was, for example, one of the things we find in these objects is what we call meteoric iron. Now, what's the difference between meteoric iron and just digging iron on the Earth? Well, we go by a ratio of another element, which is nickel. So there's a nickel-iron ratio that is specific to a nickel-iron meteorite. So it doesn't make any difference whether it's passing through our solar system or somewhere else in the Milky Way galaxy. That ratio of nickel to iron is going to be the same. So we can deem it meteoric in origin, or meteoric iron, and that's what we find in these objects. So it's more than just the isotopic ratios. It's
some other ratios as well. Okay, I hate to cut you off, but we have a break that's taking over here in less than 10 seconds, and I want to get right back into this right where we're leaving off when we come back from this break. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Dr. Roger Lear. Dr. Lear, when we went away for break, you were explaining to us, or you had just explained to us, about the, it's not just the isotopic ratios, but there are other ratios involved that help us know where things come from. So here's my question about this, the one that was transmitting on the deep space frequency. Was anyone able to determine where, since it's non-terrestrial, where did those materials come from?
Not on that particular object, because when we found this, we didn't have the technical ability, so to speak, to know what exactly to look for. Later on, we found that the nanotechnological aspect of it with the carbon nanotubes. And from that, one of our PhD board members, Dr. Robert Kuntz, who is a PhD nuclear physicist, went ahead and did a mathematical ratio calculation based on the decay of boron. And when boron decays, it becomes beryllium. This takes X amount of time. So on this X factor, using a mathematical constant for the universe, based on what we know of the origin of the universe, the time of the origin of the universe, he was able to make a calculation and told us that the objects, the objects or the materials, let's put it that way, come from approximately one-third away across the Milky Way galaxy. And this in calculation to based on our own longevity here on Earth, from what we know, would have to come to from a race of beings. If they lived in the same area as to where the objects came from, they would have to be at least 30,000 years older than we are.
That's pretty astounding.
Yes, it is. And I tried to put this information out there, but I don't know. Sometimes I get very discouraged because it's like nobody's listening, and people will come back and say, you know, the same old baloney, where's the physical evidence? Mm-hmm. Well, we've had that physical evidence now for a long time. You know, we have these things that you can hold in your hand, put on a scale. They're measurable, and we're using academic science. I don't make this stuff up. This is what these scientists tell me. So if people are not listening, you know, they can come back with all kinds of silly, stupid remarks. you know, but it's as plain as the as there's daylight in front of you. I mean, it's there. This is it. If you don't like it, well, you know, put your head in the sand. Don't look at it. But this is the way it is.
Well, and you know, you're out there speaking to people. I'm speaking to people, and we run into all kinds of people. But there's a phenomena, of course, that has come up on the internet in the UFO community, and that's the I call them the internet messiahs. They're going to protect everyone and save everyone from the nasty frauds, and consequently they call everything a fraud, so they cannot possibly ever be identified as having missed one. They have mental road rash, but we run into that. And but you know, the like you say, you know, here's the stuff, here's the evidence. It can be put on a scale, it can be photographed, it can be subjected to other tests, and this is physical evidence.
It sure is. And if we have time in this segment, I'd like to digress for a minute and tell you what experience I had since the last time I was on the air.
All right. Go ahead.
When I was at a conference last month in Scottsdale, Arizona, which was the International UFO Congress, I was asked, as well as seven other researchers from around the world, if we would like to do a extremely important presentation in Chicago. All the emphasis was that this was a very important thing if we volunteered to do this. So it sounded quite intriguing, but the information was quite lacking as to what it was about. So I agreed to go, as did our chief scientist from ANS Research, A.J. Javard, who was a leading researcher from Brazil, Antonio Urzi, who is and Simona, his wife from Italy, Jaime Musan from Mexico. Anyway, a total of seven people besides myself left and went to Chicago. We arrived there on a Friday, and we were picked up in some black SUVs with very Secret Service-like individuals. And we were taken to the, I think it's called the Stevens Center. It's a big convention center in Chicago. It's one of the biggest in the United States. And we were put up in the Hyatt Hotel, and we were told that that day was free. But the following day, we will have a one-to-one face-to-face meeting with Louis Farrakhan.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I didn't really know too much about Louis Farrakhan other than the times that I've heard him speak, and I've listened to his hate speeches, and I said, oh my God, you know, what are we getting into here? Well, this affair turned out to be what they call Savior's Day, and it's a week almost of celebration from the Farrakhan organization, which is the Islamic Nation.
Mm-hmm.
And that, we found out, has nothing to do with Islam as far as the Middle East is concerned, because their beliefs are different. They don't believe in Muhammad the Prophet, as does the Middle Eastern Muslims, but they believe in a person who was a black individual born in America by the name of Elijah Muhammad.
Mm-hmm.
And their teachings are quite a bit different. But so shorten this up, the next day we did have a private meeting with Minister Farrakhan, and he told us that we were there to talk about UFOs, because he had been talking about UFOs and their meaning for many years, and that he compared them to the wheel of Ezekiel. And there are many engineers and people who have looked at that passage from the Bible and drew the wheel of Ezekiel, and it appears to be some kind of a flying craft. Well, he said that these were operated by Space Brothers, and they were, you know, going to be coming here and have been coming here for thousands of years. Well, in private, he was a very charming individual who was very down to earth. And he told us about his personal experiences having been aboard a UFO craft and not being an abductee. So it was a very exciting event. That afternoon, we did a session which they call a plenary session. The audience, Kevin, was 14,000 people. And with this 14,000 people, you know, I always like to ask questions. I said, how many have seen a UFO? Well, about 95 to 99% of the audience raised their hand.
Wow, now that's significant.
Yeah, a tremendous, and it was like talking to people that you would see at a UFO conference. These people, you didn't have to explain what alien abduction was. They already knew.
Mm-hmm.
So it was quite an experience. Now, the following...
All right, now, let me ask you a question before we get away from that, while we're still talking about the crowd. About 14,000 people, were they mostly black people? And there's a reason I'm asking that.
Yes, they were black.
Now, here's why I asked that question. I have had it said to me, you know, I've been doing this show now for a number of years, more than 10 years. And over the years, I've been asked this question a few times, or a statement has been made where this topic comes up a few times. And that is, why is it, pardon me, why is it that the UFO phenomenon seems to be a WASP, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant phenomenon. Why does it seem to be a white people's thing? And you hardly ever hear about black people that have seen and experienced UFOs. And I'm glad you brought this up, because I've been saying that just because we don't have that information in all the reports, that doesn't mean that all those reports came from white people. It's an everybody's thing. And so here you're speaking to 14,000 people, most of them, I guess, probably close to 100% black, and 95 to 99% raised their hand and said, yes, I've seen a UFO.
Well, I think I have the explanation for that. And remember, the other point I was going to make was that on the following day, we were taken to the Allstate Arena. The Allstate Arena seats 17,000 people. It was standing room only, and they were paying $30 a ticket to get in. Now, when I asked the question, how many thought that they might be involved with the alien abduction program, it was less than 5%. So interesting that you mentioned that, because I was, because in my studies, and I've virtually looked at thousands of abduction cases all around the world, mm-hmm. I've seen very few that involved black people. I mean, certainly the ones involved, the most famous case here was Betty and Barney Hill.
Yeah, and Barney was black.
And she wasn't. But that crowd, you know, that's 14, 17,000 people, just goes ahead and proves the point. That's why you don't hear about blacks being involved. But as far as sightings are concerned, or other aspects of the case, or seeing them land, or may have communication with them, it's like 99%.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it proves another point. Farrakhan and his family, his daughter was also involved. And I didn't have a long time to talk with him, but I would love to know about his parents and their parents and their parents, because we know that it runs in families. So why should it be any different for him than it was for anybody else? Now, mm-hmm. maybe there's something in the black genetics, black DNA, that is not the people they intend to manipulate DNA with. And this historically, it could be a very, very important fact, because it's very possible that the first man, the first Homo sapien, was not white. It was most, from that area of the world.
All right, we have to step away for break. We'll pick up right there when we come back. More with Dr. Lear right after this. Welcome back. You're listening to The Kevin Smith Show. This evening, my guest is Dr. Roger Lear. Dr. Lear, when we went away for break, we were talking about this phenomenon, this thing about it seems that when it comes to sightings, very large numbers of all colors of people, all types of people, have seen UFOs. When it comes to abductions, you said, and I've heard this before, that only about 5% of this audience that you spoke to, and these in majority, in great majority, it's a black audience, and only about 5% had any experience with the abduction thing. And then we were talking about, you know, that the first Homo sapien was very likely not white, and I would say that I think that's almost certain that the first Homo sapien was not white. Even in the Bible where it talks about Adam, Adam is not a name, it's a word. It means red man. So Adam was a man of color.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Okay. So you spoke to this crowd and all these other stellar speakers that you mentioned speak to this huge crowd about UFOs and extraterrestrials. How did they receive it?
They were so into it that, you know, I'll tell you this. A.J. Girard from Brazil gave such a tremendous presentation that he got a standing ovation. He was the first one to speak. I was nearly one of the last ones. And I thought that I was well received. In fact, we were all well received, but AJ got a standing ovation. And then at the end, they cleared an area of about 15 feet in front of the stage. And then there was a large security force there, and they allowed the public to come up and stand behind an imaginary line, and they let them shake hands with us and ask questions. And these people who were asking the questions, I must say they were very, very well informed. And maybe I might even go so far as to say they were better informed than some of the UFO audiences.
Well, you know, I really think that that's evidence of what a lot of us have been saying, and that is on this subject, there's a large part of the population whose minds are coming alive with it now. I don't suspect that the majority of the population will, but a very large number are coming alive with this information now. And, you know, unfortunately, we still have obstacles to getting to the truth. And they're, I think, unreasonable obstacles. Some of the obstacles that are out there are reasonable. Some of the secrecy is reasonable. You know, if there's technology involved that would be dangerous in the wrong hands, sure, it needs to be secret. I understand that. But just the mere fact of the reality of these extraterrestrials and the reality of their presence on this earth, I don't understand why anybody thinks that needs to be a secret, because it's not a secret. You know, I mean, it's officially a secret, but the whole world knows that when governments tell us, there's nothing to that, we know that's not true. The world knows that extraterrestrials visit this planet. And so why not just come out with it? What do you think?
I think you're right on. Some self-appointed authority decided that this wasn't to be public information, so they've kept it from everybody. But, you know, I think that the planet is waking up. And if they don't wake up, it's going to be too late, because there's some things happening rapidly right now around the world. There, you know, the uprisings in the Middle East, weather changes, increase in volcanism, increase in earthquake activity, tidal activity, tsunamis, all these things, weather changes. There's something happening, and even the ill-informed sees that something is happening.
When you said if they don't wake up, it's going to be too late, what do you mean by that? What do you mean by it will be too late?
Well, for whatever is in store for the future, unless man is prepared for it, they're not going to survive.
Okay.
You know,
I agree.
Weather changes or something else.
Yeah, I agree. Surprises of that nature are never fun. And, you know, we don't ever know when an earthquake is going to hit, and we don't know where. But if we are prepared in case, then it's not as big a surprise. We have a plan. We have a means and a way and a method to survive it. If we survive the initial earthquake. So yeah, I agree. Waking up, before it's too late, I think that's the right way to look at it. Did you present to this audience the information about these implants?
I certainly did. That was, my topic, and that's what I presented. Now, I think it was an interesting pick of researchers because we had different sub-subjects that we were experts on and talking about. Some of the other guys like Jaime showed, some of the videos and still photographs of what's going on in the skies over Mexico. The folks from Italy showed, the audience what's happening over in the skies in Italy and other places in the world. AJ talked about what's happening in Brazil, both politically with the release of thousands of pages of secret classified information from the government. So each one of us that contributed, Don Schmidt was there, talking mm-hmm. about Roswell.
Yeah.
You don't have to be from the U.S. to know what Roswell is. You can go to South Africa, and you mention Roswell. They all know what Roswell is. Some of them don't know where Disneyland is, but they know where Roswell, New Mexico is.
Yeah. Yeah. So what was the purpose of this meeting? Why did Minister Farrakhan want all of his people to be exposed to this? What was his goal here?
Well, his goal is, as I indicated before, that he has biblically taken the passage about the wheel of Ezekiel quite literally, and based on his own experiences has been teaching that the wheel of Ezekiel are UFOs or non-terrestrial craft driven by advanced beings from somebody else, but they're all part of God's children and related to humankind. He could say whatever he wants to about the Catholic Church, but what has the Vatican been talking about for the last several years, and with emphasis in the last few months? The same thing.
Mm-hmm. That's curious, isn't it?
Yeah, and why now?
Because the Roman Catholic Church and the Minister Farrakhan's Nation of Islam would be worlds apart theologically. But on that issue, they seem to be in agreement. All right, we have to step away for break. We'll be back right after this. We're going to get into that UFO footage I told you about. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. For those of you joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. I'm glad you're here. We're talking this evening with Dr. Roger Lear. And, fascinating information in that first hour. Now, I mentioned Dr. Lear in the first hour. I mentioned that, there's a certain kind of set of questions that arise from the information that you provide about these implants. Then we go to this video, this footage that you shot, and the close up, the zoom in of that, and the amazing stuff that was found, video footage of a UFO in Turkey. When we put that information together with the stuff from the implant, I have a whole new set of questions. But let's first deal with this this UFO sighting and video from Turkey. Now, I'm going to show, for those who are in our members area and you're watching on our TV channel, I'm going to show you a very brief clip of the video. But this goes back to 2007 when the first video was shot, and then 2008, this craft, or one very much like it, shows up again, another video. 2009, 2010. And I just want to ask you, now you told us the last time that you were here in response to a caller's question that you were there, I believe you said, in 2008, 2009, and 2010. Is that correct?
No, I was not there in 2010. And to get our facts crystal clear, I don't want any credit for shooting the video. I actually did not shoot the video. It was not my camera. But I fortunately happened to be with the party there who got a chance to look through the camera as we were shooting it.
Okay. Fair enough. Now, so you were there in 2008 and 2009. The shots from 2007, the shots from 2008, the shots from 2009, all of those appear to be the same UFO.
Certainly do, but, you know, again, to put the facts straight, if we took a shot of a, let's use the Southwest Airlines for a minute, one of their 737s, and then we took another one and then another one, they'd probably look the same.
Yeah, fair enough, fair enough. But what I was getting at and what it could indicate, if it's not the same UFO, it could indicate that what we're dealing with is the same civilization.
Oh, yeah, because you know, the last one that was shot, a lot of attention was paid to the beings that were there, and the analysis that was done in Chile, the video analysts there spent most of the time on the beings and what they were doing, and we know that there was more than one kind of critter in there.
Mm-hmm.
He describes, you know, at least two. There are probably others.
Well, and that's where I want to go, because... And by the way, those who are watching are seeing a little film clip of this UFO. Now, this is some of the clearest video of UFOs out there. Now, there are some others that are pretty clear, but this is among the best. Very, very clear. And what happened was, if you take a still shot of that UFO, we can see that, well, I'm going to describe the way it appears to me. It appears to me, this UFO, to be perhaps kind of a bat wing or a half moon shaped. It may be completely circular because it's taken at nighttime. But it sort of has that appearance to me. But right at, if it is sort of a bat wing, right where the nose of this bat wing would be, where the two sides come together, where they meet, right in the center, we see what looks like an open hatch. And we see two little orb things there. But when you zoom in on that, those orbs take on the appearance quite clearly of classic gray aliens. All right. Now, talk to us about this a little bit. Who did the photo analysis, and who found these gray aliens standing there in this? I don't know. It looks like to me they've got the front door open.
I just took some criticism a couple of days ago through the website because we have a place where people can make comments and so on. And this guy said, well, you're not going to sell me on the fact that this is a craft from anywhere else, because why would craft coming from somewhere else that were non-earthly have windows in the front? You know, and all I could do was laugh, because we've had many, many, many abductees who are aboard a craft, and they didn't see any windows at all. But what they do see is a technology where the occupants of the craft can make the structure absolutely transparent. So I don't like calling them windows, but I think what they are is viewing ports. And with remember how the craft was lit in that video. The craft was lit from the moon, which was not that far away. So there was a very bright moon, and so most of the external lighting was from the moon. And then you have to have a pretty good lighting source, you know, on the inside of the craft that would show what it did in these viewing ports. So, no, I don't think they're windows at all, as I said.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
And we've just, I just learned also only a few weeks ago that they have been able to take aluminum and use high-intense lasers and ultraviolet and make the aluminum transparent.
Well, there you go.
So, you know, all these things look like magic and impossibilities are advanced technology. And what Gene Roddenberry, you know, talked about in Star Trek and some of the other, you know, famous science fiction writers, we're going to see come to pass. I mean, again, to digress for a second, you know, in medicine, for example, when Star Trek started, they had people aboard the Enterprise, and they were going into the abdomen and taking out, amniotic fluid, so to speak, or you heard abductees talk about it. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's impossible. You know, it's a bunch of beans. Now it's an everyday procedure. You know, it wasn't done then. Nobody ever heard of that. You can't do that. How can you stick a needle in, you know, and take fluid out? Impossible. You're going to, you know, kill the fetus or whatever. So even some of the equipment that Star Trek had in some of the earlier programs is now in use medically.
Yeah. Okay. I want you to take us to Turkey and describe this video from which we see the two aliens. Was this in 2008 or 2009?
Well, it was filmed in the same place, which is a small town on the European coast called Comburgas. And Istanbul is geographically situated where it's almost surrounded by water. So you have various oceans and inlets that are around the area. Also, Turkey is an interesting country, again, geographically, because it's the only country that's on two continents. Part of Turkey is in Asia, and part of Turkey is in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So there's really two coasts. So on the European side is where we went, because there had been reported a lot of craft activity with these craft coming in and out of the sea or coming from the sea towards the land. So we stayed up from about 12 midnight to almost 6 o'clock in the morning with the cameras on sticks pointed out over the ocean. And that wasn't the only craft that was captured on video. There was a lot of them. Some of them came out of the sea You know, some of them were typical saucer-looking craft with lights going around them. But the activity was very vigorous. And I remember I had been over there for a conference, and right over the convention center in a hotel where the conference was going on, these craft were being seen all day long. All the major news trucks, television news, were out there, and they were filming them. So let's say by the time I left Turkey, I had my fill of seeing UFOs. I might as well have been on the freeway and looking at the rush hour.
Okay, but now back to the date of these. The one where we see the aliens, is that from 2008 or 2009?
That one, I believe, is from 2009.
Okay. Now
I have footage of both. Uh-huh. And to tell you the truth, my webmaster, I don't know which one he put up on the website, but they were so similar, one was just about as good as the other one.
Okay. Now, 2008, you're there, you see these, they're filmed. 2009, you're there, you see them, they're, and this one is, you get to look through the camera and see it through the camera. Were you at the same location?
Yes.
And then, was it at the same time of year?
Yes.
We're coming up on that now. We're not far. I think it was June?
I believe so, right.
Yeah, May, June, somewhere along in there. We're coming up on that. It's coming up soon. And I wonder, because apparently they showed up again in 2010. I'm wondering if that's going to happen in 2011. However, having asked that question, let me ask you this. Is it possible that that was a dumb question? Because maybe they're out there every night.
Well, they may be out there every night, but I think there's some evidence that we saw that and we were able to film it because they wanted us to see it and film it. Otherwise, we would have been filming it, you know, like over the convention center. I mean, why in that particular geographical area? I want to bring up another point, which is in Camarillo, California here, about 15 years ago, we had a sighting just after Thanksgiving that went on only at that particular time of year for 13 years. We couldn't get anybody. I called every astronomical society that, you know, we might get out there, but not one single one of them would show any interest in it whatsoever. But we did get film of it through a Celestron 6 telescope, and it was one heck of a sighting.
Why do you think you couldn't get any of the astronomical societies to be interested in it?
I think that it's peer pressure from within. I was told by one of the local colleges here who had an astronomy department, we don't get involved with UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
And I argued with them, and I said, I'm not saying this was a UFO. I said, it looks to me like it's either an astronomical event or some kind of a weather phenomena. Well, we just can't be bothered with that kind of stuff.
That sounds like someone who knew exactly what it was, you know, they knew it was not a weather phenomenon, and they knew it was not an astronomical event. That's why they were avoiding it.
Yeah, either that or, you know, I'm not going to go out there and look at it because, hell, if it got word around the department I did that, you know, I might not be working here tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's the way it is here in the land of the free.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Now, I said there are a set of questions that arise in my mind when we put these videos together, and especially where we've got a close-up of what very clearly looks like gray aliens at the front of that craft.
But not just in the front. I mean, the two peripheral windows also.
Yeah.
They're the same beings.
Yeah. I saw a close-up of one other, and I'm sure there were other photographs, but I found a close-up of one other. But look, when we put that together with the fact that you're finding, over the years, implants in people that are of non-terrestrial origin. You've been able to, nuclear physicists figured out that one of those, based on its materials, had to have come from about a third of the way across the Milky Way galaxy. You put that together with these videos, and here's the set of questions, and we'll start with this one. Do you think... well, let me preface it with this. Most of the time when we hear people talk about being taken on board a craft and they have medical examinations done and they're aware that an implant has been put in them, most of those testimonies are telling us that it's what we call the grays that are doing this. Okay, so here we've got a UFO, we've got grays standing there. Is it possible that what we're looking at here is connected with these implants that are of non-terrestrial origin and some transmitting on deep space frequency? Is there a connection between them, do you think?
No, I don't think so, because... what advanced civilization that you would consider would communicate through electromagnetic spectrum by use of an ancient radio wave technology? Why don't we just give up radio, period? And Kevin, you could do your show with smoke signals.
I thought that's what you were going to tell us.
We'll just use smoke signals.
Yeah.
I think that the biggest indication of why we find that there is a radio wave within our known electromagnetic spectrum operating on certain specific frequencies is that somebody else is tuning in, and that whoever else, that other else is human, not extraterrestrial.
Okay. Now, I thought that's where you would go with this, because in the back of my mind, I sort of remember asking something similar in one of your previous appearances here on the show. All right, so if it's not these guys that are connected with these implants, and if it's some earthly, some terrestrial entity, maybe... government, maybe private industry, who knows, that's listening in on these transmissions, then it would seem to indicate that it is an earthly entity that built the transmitter, that built the little implant.
Well, let's not oversimplify it. That's not the case. Let's just presume something for a moment. We know that scalar waves travel faster than the speed of light. You can develop a technology based on scalar waves and communicate, just again, as it is in Star Trek, with subspace frequencies, a scalar wave technology. Let's say that's how these, let's assume for a moment, hypothetically, that this is a technology or the way these materials operate, or where this device operates, let's say. But let's say somebody else of an earthly origin says, okay, you go ahead and you can abduct our population. You can do this and you can do that, but... we want to know what's going on, too. So, therefore, they hang something on this which is converted into a radio wave so they can listen to your private phone conversation.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's my personal belief, is somebody has made an agreement and somebody is listening to somebody else's phone call.
Okay, so then we're back to extraterrestrial origins for the object itself.
Right.
So why couldn't it be these guys that you see in Turkey?
Well, it certainly could.
Okay.
It certainly could. Now, you know, I think that the information that they are acquiring could, again, hypothetically be based on what they're doing here in the first place. You know, if people all over the planet are being taken aboard ship and something is being done to them, the majority of reports of all these things involve the taking of ova and sperm. It doesn't take too much of a brain to think that if you're taking ova and sperm, then you're doing something genetically. So again, hypothetically, let's say that they are doing some gene splicing and some altering of human DNA, which we can easily pass on to our offspring by interbreeding and essentially changing the human, changing the texture of the human into something else, which maybe might be a little bit better for the planet and non-altruistically for other life in the universe than what we have now. You want to know what the progress of that is. So just like if we do something on a whale, do some kind of repair or surgery or something, we want to know how that whale gets along in their own environment in the ocean. So we implant them and we listen to the data. Astronauts going, I remember it was one of John Glenn, I think, complained about having to swallow implants, and those were necessary so that the biometric data could be fed back to source on ground control. They didn't like it, but they did it. So this might be something similar. This is data, not particularly communications as to what you had for breakfast or what your intentions are for the next week or what you're going to tell your boss, but possibly biometric data based on experimentation that was done at some other time.
Okay, but then what? But now that has to do with the extraterrestrials gathering data. But right. What you said earlier is that there may also be some agreement where the ETs hang a little extra function on it so that some terrestrial person or group can listen in on what you're doing.
Yeah, well, they may be acquiring the data as well for their own nefarious purposes.
That's interesting. Why do you think they would use the deep space frequency?
Well, because deep space frequencies, the information can be safely gathered without anybody else eavesdropping that they don't want. You know, everything that branch of either government or a secret component of something is steeped in the ultimate of secrecy. It's even far more than the classification of need to know. It's even deeper than that. So you want to be safe. You don't want things happening like what happened to the fellow in Canada.
Okay, we'll talk about the fellow in Canada when we come back from break. We'll be back, folks, with Dr. Roger Lear right here on the Kevin Smith Show right after this. I haven't haven't figured out why, but it always works better when I push the button. I thought I pushed that button. Must be getting old. All right. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Dr. Roger Lear. Okay, Dr. Lear, you were talking about a guy in Canada, and we had to go to break.
Say again?
You were talking about a guy in Canada. You said it'd be better than what happened to the guy in Canada, and then we had to go to break. So I wanted to give you the opportunity to finish your thought.
Yeah, there was a fellow in Canada who had an uplink facility, or I should say uplink and downlink, and he was getting the raw NASA footage before it had to go through its Mixmaster, where they could wipe out anything they didn't want the public to know. And he, his name was Martin Stubbs.
Yeah.
And he collected hours and hours and hours of this footage. And that's the footage that finally got out on the internet and was released through UFO Magazine UK. And it showed all kinds of UFO activities going on in space and near the shuttle. It also had the experiment where the shuttle dragged the line behind it through the magnetosphere to generate electricity. And you could see when it created so much electricity, the thing blew up. And then there was, I don't know, must have been hundreds of UFOs that came into the area and looked like they were getting firsthand observation of the phenomena. Well, that's, you know, they don't want that kind of stuff to happen. So if we're dealing with a situation in which ETs are being allowed to do what they do in exchange for something else, which we don't know, as I'm sure they will want something back, then this is not supposed to be for public knowledge.
Thus the deep space frequency, because that's not something that could be easily monitored. All right. Do you have any speculations about who would be behind that?
I don't like to use a broad brush to apply paint to a subject that's so complex, because it's far beyond government anymore. I think the knowledge that once the government had with MJ-12 and some of the other organizations, I think that's now probably gotten in the hands of the multi-conglomerate corporate world industries, and I think they're the ones that are probably hold the knowledge. And maybe there's even a smaller clique having to do with them that's layered. I say this only from the knowledge of how they kept the Manhattan Project a secret. The business about not being able to keep a secret is a bunch of baloney. If you layer things so that you have a very small circle to begin with, and then you form these outer layers, and the outermost layer has absolutely no contact with the inner circle, then you've pretty well secured information, and then you can lie to the population and talk about weather balloons and swamp gas and weather distortion phenomenon.
Oh, I like the favorite one from England.
Besides.
Yeah, I like the favorite excuse from England. It's Chinese wedding candles. I like that. Yeah.
Yeah, also birds. A mm-hmm. flock of birds.
Yeah.
Look what they did with the 1942 Battle of Los Angeles footage. A friend of mine who's a producer here, Jose Escamilla, is doing a new film, The Battle of Los Angeles, which we hope will be out in the last quarter of the year. But he bought the actual footage from CBS. And there's been, since the movies have come out, these fictional portrayals of the Battle of Los Angeles. They've made statements. Somebody's trying to explain this away by saying this was a balloon. Well, I know for a fact that at least 70,000 rounds of AK-AK were fired at this thing at one time. If you can't take out a balloon with 70,000 rounds of ACAC, then poorest doggone excuse for defense.
Yeah, you know, I've had Jose on the show talking about this movie that he's making, The Battle of Los Angeles, and it uses the actual footage. And a lot of people may think that the story is fictional. It's not. It really happened. And there's actual television news footage of this battle taking place and where they're firing at this thing. One of the things that he and I talked about was what a lame excuse that was. But there's a very interesting point in the real history of the Battle of Los Angeles, and that is that you had this top guy in Washington. I forget what his rank was, but the next morning he says, well, there was nothing to it. It was misidentification, or it was jittery nerves. And you had the local commander in California saying, to heck with that. We had a real craft up there, and we fired at it. And there was no jittery nerves. It was a real deal. And so there was, for a period of days, there was this real tension between the people on the ground and the people in Washington. And that's a real part of history. And it actually, that shows up in the newspapers back then, the disagreement between them.
Yeah. And to see, how many years since 1942, it's just become, local news that the Japanese had subs that are still sitting on the ocean floor in the Catalina Gulf. The 26-mile channel between the coast of Southern California and Catalina Island. Mm-hmm. The Japs subs are still sitting there.
Yeah.
And who was to know anything about that? They told the public they never came to the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, well.
it's pretty. Now, incidentally, too, that footage, I've seen it, the footage that Jose has, and that didn't just start when they started firing the ACAC over the ocean. That craft was seen coming down, crossing the San Fernando Valley.
Yeah.
And there wasn't one of them. There was more than one.
Mm-hmm. And then after they fired all those rounds of ammunition, and, I mean, you can see they had to be making hits on this thing. I mean, you can see some of the pictures where you have the explosion flash right next to this UFO. Where you had detonation of the round, it didn't bother the UFO, and they just sort of sauntered off over the ocean when they left.
Yeah, didn't bother it one iota. And again, I hate to keep pounding on Gene Roddenberry, but shield technology.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and who knows if we're not flying stuff right now with the same technology.
All right. Maybe it was a craft like the one that you have seen in Turkey. And I think it's important for us. It's one thing to say, okay, Roger Lear was there, Roger Lear saw it. But then you've got all these people out there that say, well, yeah, but Roger Lear could lie. Okay, this video has been examined. It has been analyzed by very professional people. Tell us about that.
Well, the first analysis was done by the University of Turkey, I think, in Istanbul. And they looked at it from the standpoint of whether this real footage. Was this a light aberration? Was it some kind of a bounce phenomena off of clouds? So they went into a very in-depth analysis, and it took quite a few days to do this. And they were the first ones that came out and said, no, this is a genuine video of a solid object, and the object is what it appears to be in the video. Well, that was a pretty good solid evidence. And then a few years later, a videographer, analyst, a very good one in Chile, took the analysis and went one step further with it. He spent most of his time and emphasized what was going on inside the craft by the beings that were seen through the viewing ports. And he not only described in detail and added to them with a computer their characteristics, but he was able to use what's called a frame splitter, because each frame of video, there's 30 frames per second. And so if you use a frame splitter, you can break it up into two. Each frame is worth the two fields. So it gives you, you know, 60 fields per second. And so he looked at what went on in each of these fields, and he showed in the report what they were doing while we were filming them.
Such as? What did he come up with?
Well, I knew you were going to ask me that, and I don't remember. But they were engaged in some kind of a purposeful act. I don't remember what it was. But I think if you listeners want to go on any search engine and put in turkey footage, or the Cumbergas turkey footage, 2008-2009, Chile analysis, they can read that in detail. I don't know if it's up on my website. I have to go look. We did have it up for a while. Whether it's still there or not, I don't know. But if it isn't, I'm going to have my webmaster put it back up.
Okay, here comes the $64,000 question. You've been there in 2008, 2009. You've seen them. And now, because of the video that was shot with the camera that you viewed through, we've seen them. What are they up to?
Well, you know, again, these acts look purposeful to me. I've had so many indications and personal experiences where they have the ability to read your mind, just like they were reading a newspaper. Who knows? Maybe they were recording us filming them for, you know, a report they're doing on Earth beings. I don't know, but I got a sneaking suspicion that they knew exactly what was going on, and that was no accident. I don't think either time. You know, and some people have asked me, yeah, this is a good tie-in for you and your line of thought that you began the show with. Why is it? I didn't ask to do this kind of implant surgery, and if somebody told me I'd have been doing that kind of thing 30 years ago, I'd have told them they were crazy. Why is it that I seem to be able to do it, take out, you know, a solid 3D objects to submit to science for analysis, when nobody in the past and nobody else right now is doing the same thing?
What's your answer?
My answer is the same thing that we were just discussing. I think it's some kind of a purposeful act. Maybe it's to present scientific knowledge to help educate the public at large. You know, I just got an invitation to go to Turkey in June, and they have 3 to 5 implant surgeries.
All right, we have to step away for break, and we'll be back. Pick up right there when we come back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Dr. Roger Lear. And we've been talking about implants and aliens and various possible connections between some of the implants that he has removed from people and the possibility they may be connected to some of these aliens we've been looking at here tonight and talking about here tonight. Dr. Lear, we're on final approach here. We only have a few minutes left. I got two questions for you. And I'm going to ask, just on in case it takes a while for us to discuss this, I'm going to ask the biggest one first. Have you ever suspected that you have been implanted?
Oh, I thought we passed that $64,000 question. I've had some suspicions that I wrote about in the my first book, The Aliens and the Scalpel, that some very unusual dreams I had were possible non-terrestrial experiences, plus the fact that at one time, by accident, I was examining a patient with the ultraviolet light, and the person that was with me, who was from MUFON, noticed that I was glowing better than the patient was. So it is a possibility, but as to where, if I have an object, to where it would be, I wouldn't have the slightest idea.
Okay. Now, the next question takes us back to a statement that you made in the last segment of the show, where you said there have been, you know, so many reports of where these beings can read your mind. And that's true. I mean, those reports proliferate. If they can read our minds, why would they need or want or rely upon implants?
Well, as I stated before, I don't think the implants, as we call them, are devices for communication whatsoever. I think they're only devices for collecting biometric data, e.g., if you do some DNA changes, how does this affect, you know, some kind of cellular reproduction, or how does this affect, you know, some of the neural changes that occur in your brain? And if we couple this with what we see in the children being born within the last 50, 60, 75 years, it looks to me like we're going from Homo sapien to maybe Homo noeticus, because it's the young people who have now the world in their palm. And if you notice the recent events in the Middle East, look at the ages of the people who are involved. These are the young people again, and they're using the social media, the internet, Facebook, Twitter, and so on, to pursue revolutionary causes. This is the first time in history where kings are being ousted and replaced with presidents. This is a historical event, but the important thing is that it's being done by young people, not by older folk. So perhaps this is a good indication that the avenue that I'm pursuing, as to what this abduction stuff is all about and what the implant's all about, maybe that has some credibility.
Well, as you mentioned, these implants, from what you've been able to determine, seem to be probably related to collection and transmission of biometric data. And that would be to track the progress of basically their experiment. If that's the case, you know, there are a lot of folks who think that, you know, once they determine that there's intervention going on, they think this is something new. But we know from ancient manuscripts that biological intervention is probably how we got here. So it's not new.
What's new is that there are people talking about it, and the secrecy is, or the veil of secrecy is being peeled away. Nobody ever asked in the past, wouldn't dare to ask, for fear that you would be doing something sacrilegious as to where we came from. Now people are asking, you know, why? You know, why do we have two arms, two legs, a head, a mouth? Why do we look the way we do? Why do we have to wear clothes to protect us from our environment when there's not a single living animal on the face of this earth that requires clothing to survive?
Mm-hmm. Those are good questions. Maybe because we're hybrids.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Well, I believe very much, you know, in the work that Zachariah Sitchin did with the translating the Sumerian tablets, and he said that 435,000 years ago, the Anunnaki came here, and Enki was their chief genetic engineer, and they did their own, you know, they did gene splicing and DNA manipulation with primitive man that was already here on the planet, which would have probably been Neanderthal. And, you know, the Neanderthal offshoot probably progressed, went its way, and they produced a Homo sapien.
Well, you know, the geneticists say we have 223 genes that have none, they have no evolutionary predecessors. So what that means in plain English is we have 223 genes that are not from here.
Yes, right on, Kevin. We got 223 genes that were not made by Levi Strauss.
Well, listen, I really appreciate you coming and talking with us this evening. It's been absolutely captivating. Tell us again your website. And by the way, do you have a book that you're promoting these days?
Well, some of the newer books are still being printed. They're still on the market. We have both editions of the Aliens in the Scalpel, Edition 1, Edition 2. Edition 1 is available as a book on tape. It's 510 minutes of me reading the book with sound effects. Edition 2 is a regular book. Then we have the UFO crash in Brazil, which is my investigation of the 1996 Virginia case, complete with interviews of all the witnesses and discussion.
Okay, now, are all these available at your website?
Yeah, they're all available through the website. And let's tell the folks also that if they purchase any of the items on the website, it's not a purchase, it's a gift to A&F's research, and we will gift them back the product. So they're not really buying anything. They're just helping with the research, because that's where the money goes. And there's also an area that if somebody wants to donate a dollar or 50 cents, it costs them nothing. They can do it through PayPal. And that it all adds up at the end of the day. And just one more test, you know, just one more test to do. And all this information, I guarantee you, belongs to every man, woman, and child on the face of this planet. And that's what we intend to do, is to keep it coming.
All right. I want to thank you again for being with us. Stay on the line with me for a moment, if you will. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to be it. That's a wrap for this evening. Don't forget that this week we're offering my book, Gods in the Garden. It's $9. Gods in the Garden, $9 as an ebook. You can download it immediately. But it's over on Saturday, so get it now. My friends call me Steel Eye, my enemies do too, and you can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.